Developmental Alternatives with Women for a New Era, ORDON, is a network of feminist scholars, researchers and activists from the economic south working for economic and gender justice and sustainable and democratic development. This recording is done by Dawn as a way of sharing its feminist critical analysis of the global environment through the voices of women from the south. Other recordings are available for download at www.dawnnet.org and may be used freely following proper citation. Dawn Podcasts, the voices of women creating a just world.
We'll move now to Africa, to Hibis Kasa, who is going to speak about market reform and food crisis in Africa, locating women as agents of change.
Well, in any discussion of the political economy of Africa, one of the first things that ought to be mentioned is the structure of the African economy. And it's essentially a supplier of raw materials to the global economy. And this structure was something that came into what took form during the colonial era, during its experience in the colonial era. And this structure has largely not changed since then to date. And one of the key developments in the continent, especially in the 1970s, that had a major influence in public policy making was the emergence of the debt crisis. And this was directly linked to the distortions that emanated from the structure of the economy of Africa. So the structural adjustment programs were introduced into the continent pushed by the World Bank and the IMF. And these policies basically sought state withdrawal as a solution to the structural problems that the continent faced. However, as I've said already, it required the withdrawal of the state. And all of this had implications for agricultural policy on the continent. One of the things about it was that it promoted the production of export crops on the assumption that increased participation in the global markets would benefit Africa. This was buttressed by the view that the liberalization of trading relations with advanced capitalist states and would benefit the continent. And policies such as the removal of subsidies for the agricultural sector were implemented. And all of this, the underlying logic and the framework within which this was took shape was the neoliberal economic ideology. And the logic underlying this was that basically market forces will determine the distribution of resources. This implied that the public's interest would not necessarily determine public policy. So what were the consequences of this? In order to establish appreciate the impact that it had, it helps to also look at the what structural adjustments those proponents of structural adjustment expected it to provide to produce, the results it was expected to produce. One of the first things is economic growth, and a second major factor is the reduction of the debt burden in Africa. And the purpose of all of this was to make these economies viable in the global economic system. The consequences, however, were characterized by falling living standards, loss of social security and access to basic social services, a sharp expansion in the size of the informal sector, and the gradual casualization of the labor force. All of this had implications for women. There was an increasing use of the term of the feminization of poverty in development dialogue. The survival of households increasingly became the burden of women. And as a result of this, in order to appreciate this in terms of how women are being impacted by it, it's important to realize that the majority of women fall within the ranks of the urban and rural poor. Therefore, their access to healthcare, education and employment was severely undermined by these trends. So it's important to take into consideration the fact that if one is pursuing the liberation of women in the economic south, it's important to take into consideration the social, economic, and political systems, and to understand or to determine whether these systems actually are genuinely responsive to the needs of women and the broader society. And in order to ensure that this actually occurs, it requires there to be an execution of a political project, which would result in the reversal of neoliberal policies or capitalist-oriented public policies. And the food crisis illustrates this imperative. If you examine the issue of land appropriation in the continent and the emphasis on export production, it has direct implications for women. Women form the bulk of the majority of small-scale farmers who are important players in the agricultural sector in Africa. The promotion of export crops and agriculture had the effect of encouraging farmers to reduce the food crop production. But because women have essentially an important role to play at the household level, they are expected to ensure that there's food security at the household level, especially when you're talking about rural women farmers. So ultimately, the task of food production fell largely on women. The history of this can be tied to the colonial era. A deliberate policy action was taken to drive men into wage labor sectors of the economy. And this had the impact of leaving women to fill the gap left by men. And this is actually a deliberate colonial policy, which largely seems not to have changed in terms of its orientation and the emphasis on export food production. Interestingly, boosting the productive capacity of the small-scale farmer has gained a lot of attention in recent years in Africa. I could cite the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and it has largely positioned itself within this framework. However, a closer examination of this of the Alliance for the Green Revolution, AGRA, reveals that it's seeking to create viable conditions for large agribusinesses to make investments in Africa. This drive is largely a product for increasing demand for food in the global market. Therefore, arable lands have increased in their value. And this has created a lot of, it has produced a lot of interesting and worrying trends in Africa. Some have referred to this as a form of agrarian colonialism. If one looks at the estimates of the conservative estimates of the World Bank, 9 million hectares of land have been acquired in four African countries alone. That's Ethiopia, Liberia, Mozambique, and Sudan. It's often been the case that multinational corporations have been identified as the key actors driving these processes. But it's also important to look at the complicity of the African political elites in this process, the political and economic elites in this process. For example, in the purchase of 20,000 hectares of land in Mozambique, the Mauritius government used a lot of its diplomatic leverage to ensure that a company called Vitagreen would be able to succeed in acquiring the 20,000 hectares of land. And apart from this, we have also the instance of Libya Africa investment portfolio, which is owned by the Libyan government, which made similar investments in Liberia and Mali of 15,000 and 100,000 hectares respectively. Now, if you look at the production targets of the Libyan African investment portfolio and Vitagreen in Mozambique, they are 40,000 and 150,000 tons of rice annually. Ironically, in January 2011, Japan donated 17,000 tons of rice to Mozambique. So this shows the bankruptcy of the export-driven kind of agricultural policies in Africa, if you're talking about food security. In order to appreciate the extent of the sheer complexity of the food crisis facing the continent, it's essential to reflect on climate justice. The current erratic climatic conditions have been worsened by scarcity in arable lands in Africa. And historically, this has been due to the rise of the industrialized capitalist states. And in this regard, the historic debt of the economic north cannot be ignored. However, it's important to consider once again the role that some African leaders have played in recent years to entrench climate injustice, not only in Africa, but in the world. So, at the recent climate change talks in Cancun, Africa was betrayed for actually a second time by its own spokesperson at the talks, that's Meles Zenawi, the Ethiopian Prime Minister, who actually argued for the use of the Copenhagen Accord as a basis for negotiations. during the Cancun talks. And this action was not isolated. You have another leader like Raila Odinga, the Prime Minister of Kenya, who argued for $100 billion to be offered by the advanced capitalist states for all developing countries. However, the African countries had already had a position that they required $600 billion and were trying to push for that. So then that shows the inconsistencies in terms of the leadership. And if one reflects further on the nature of the regime, of the Mullah-Zenawi regime, you begin to realize that the linkages between gender, economic, and ecological justice are integrally linked to the struggles being waged by youth, workers, and feminist groups seeking social and political and economic justice. And I'm arguing this way because in 2005, there were popular protests in Ethiopia, 2 days of struggle in which 190 people, men and women, were killed by the police forces. And soon after those events, Mullah Zenawi got an invitation to the G8 summit. And that in itself is symbolic, and not just symbolic, actually reflects that the regime is supported by Western governments. And this in effect also shows that the failure of the protest movement at the time led to the entrenching of a regime that would later on betray Africa and the rest of the economic South in the pursuit of its own agenda of climate injustice. So where are women resisting in all of this? In 2008, the world was confronted with a global food crisis. According to the World Bank and FAO, food prices rose by 83% between 2005 and 2008, and by 130% between January 2002 and June 2008. And several African countries saw protests as a result of the increase in food prices. Cameroon was faced with one of the most intensified struggles. We had 20 people being killed during that period. Women were also severely affected by the food crisis and participated in these struggles. The pattern was not isolated. It was not something that was isolated to Cameroon. It was a pattern across Africa. We had Gambia, Senegal, Burkina Faso, Egypt. The list continues. It's important to understand that these protests were not triggered by a fear of starvation. It was an expression that there was a form of exploitation that they were experiencing. And as such, it was a fight for social justice. And it was not just some sort of spontaneous response to a hardship at a given point in time that can be ignored later on. In 2008, the World Bank states that 12 million people fell below the poverty line as a result of the food price increases. The current food price increases have been estimated to have led to 40 million people falling below the poverty line across the world. So, this is also something that needs to be taken note of, is that the role that young women can also play in these processes. And in order to understand that, it's also important to understand their experience. Today's generation of young people in Africa and across the world were born during a period of an intensifying economic crisis, but then also it was against the context of a world that was gradually going through a period of neoliberalization. And not only did they have to deal with their multi-layered identities, whether it's gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and class, but also to confront a world which was facing increasingly interlinked and multiple crises. And in this respect, Marjorie Mbilinyi has made special reference to African women and has argued that African women have been identified by global capital as being potentially important allies and sources of resistance to the status quo. And from what has been presented already, African women, if you are looking specifically at women farmers, on one hand, they support the system by making up for the deficit it leaves behind. And on the other hand, there are the groups ahead of at the forefront of the struggle when conditions or hardships is created and it's no longer within conditions within which the survival of their households is put under threat. So, and one also reflects that the current developments in North Africa and the Greater Middle East, one realizes how the potential that the bottled up frustrations of young people can have and to transform their own societies. And it's also important to look at to also identify that the role that the current food crisis and high unemployment rates have played in these protests. And young women in these countries have organized and participated in these struggles. Women's voices are heard as housewives, as the unemployed factory workers, in online social networks and traditional media outlets. The message they carry is a multi-layered one. The issues of concern to them stem from their daily battles of survival. It's the pursuit of a world that not only has equality, but equality in diversity. And it's something that has real possibility if these movements actually are able to gain momentum and actually pursue the objective of social transformation. And nowhere is such ownership of needed done in Africa. And young women must be a part of such political projects. I'd like to conclude by just raising a few questions. Basically, I think the core problem that is confronting the world today is what values are going to guide our society? What needs shall public policy serve? And how shall we confront and unravel the existing capitalist system? How can we best strategize to create conditions to ensure the world is fair and just? And is this really just the pursuit of a utopia? Or is the nature of the crisis we are facing so extreme that we really have no alternative? I think that this is a time which offers an opportunity for genuinely revolutionary political projects to be executed. I believe that hope lies in the fact that social movements are already confronting the crisis in its many facets and levels, building the capacity of activists to deepen our understanding of the problems and their manifestations in the different regions in the global south is the beginning. GEJ therefore offers an important platform where dialogue and reflection can ensure regional perspectives and experiences can be incorporated into building a knowledge base. And this would feed into young activists or activists as a whole to gain critical insights which must be translated into less fragmentation within movements and the elimination of the first separation between the global and local. The nature of the crisis facing the world demands such an approach, and it is my hope that the participation of young women will become integral to activism in Africa. It's important to trust that it's only through struggle that genuine transformation can occur. And as Trotsky says, the ideas that enter the mind and the fire remain there securely and forever. Thank you.
For more information on the work of Dawn, do not hesitate to contact us. Our email address is info@dawnnet.org.